From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Atlanta, Georgia, with a very special interview that took place in New York City. It's the last few days of what has been a very difficult year for many of us. Let's take a moment to feel gratitude that we've made it this far and to hope for a new year that brings opportunities and blessings that we are not able to imagine nor articulate from where we sit today. Best wishes to all of you for 2019. We hope for a better year together. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today, because the more people subscribe, the more visible this show will be, and that's going to make it easier for more new listeners to find us in the new year. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. We are so grateful for our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. As we enter the final days of a very, very long year, we can look back and see the changes our nation has undergone and the vulnerabilities revealed that may have been festering for a very long time. Few can guess what it's going to be like in the days ahead. But few can argue that among the emergent forces for positive change we have seen in this and recent years, progressive organized religion and women-led movements are among the greatest sources of hope for the future. That's why I'm so excited to end the year with the two individuals seated across from me right now. Each has appeared on this show before, but to have them both together and at this moment in our history is electrifying. The Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner is senior pastor at Metropolitan Community Church of New York, a congregation that she has served in various capacities for well over three decades. Next to her is Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, who serves as senior rabbi at Congregation Beit Simchat Torah, a congregation she has led since 1992. Sharon is a faith leader who has spoken out fearlessly for the inclusion of all of God's people in religious and secular life, and her recent work has included prominent partnerships with New York City's Muslim community. Rabbi Sharon, Reverend Pat, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Could I ask each of you to talk about your ministry and your activism in that phase of history when full inclusion still seemed like a very far-off thing? Whichever one of you wants to start, let's start there.
Well, I think when I started, and I've been in this church for 38 years, 6 years on staff and 32 as the pastor, New York City was a very different place. You were literally stepping over homeless people on the sidewalk. You know, I would open my door in the morning and someone would be in the doorwell. So there was that issue. Hunger was a really major issue. And queer rights were almost non-existent, in the sense that it was very daring for people to come out. They knew they risked their jobs. In some cases, they risked their homes. HIV and AIDS was beginning to express itself in different ways. And by the time I was just a few years into the ministry, it was full-blown. And I'm sure Sharon had these same kind of experiences, people coming into our offices whom doctors would not see and asking me, what did I think they had? And, you know, having to examine legs with, you know, Kaposi's sarcoma, and doing really strange things like bathing people's legs just to comfort them. You know, it had no medicinal effect, but just to make them feel like somebody cared, looking in their mouths and, you know, saying, I'm pretty sure this is thrush, try the following things. Or giving instructions because we knew so little about how to clean a bathroom so that, you know, we had no idea exactly how this was transmitted. I mean, I think we knew it was sexually transmitted, but otherwise we weren't too sure. So trying to protect people the best we could. And at the same time, really, really challenging people, trying to convince people that the only way forward was for people to have the courage to be out and open and honest about who they were and to demand what every other person in this country seemed to take for granted. I think we were very much in a learning phase in terms of trying to kind of take in the lessons of the civil rights movement and the lessons of the women's rights movement and trying to apply those as best we can, while at the same time, much of the time, groups fought each other, you know, because of the fear of losing any ground that had been attained by being associated with queer people. So I think in an overview kind of sense, that's what it was like.
I want Sharon to do the same period, but Sharon, I have to thank you because you were one of the very early guests on State of Belief, and you had confidence that someone would be listening and that we would would be treating people in a just way.
Well, thank you so much. And likewise, you've been such an important religious voice for progressive values on so many issues when religion has been consistently, unfortunately, on the wrong side, I believe, of God's dream for this world. So you've really been somebody who very early on took on very difficult issues that very few religious leaders were daring to do.
Well, thank you.
So we're very grateful to you for that.
Thank you.
So I echo everything that Pat said. And I recently gave a talk on World AIDS Day on our Shabbat for World AIDS Day. And so many young people are gathered now in our congregation who do not know a single person who died from AIDS.
Right.
And now we're a congregation of communities that have to find ways to teach and to bring in. And I'd like to offer now a couple of observations I shared then that I'm very struck by. One is that it's hard to remember that for the 20-something years that AIDS was the plague it was in the gay community in cities like New York, and it has continued to be a plague in the city for people of color and in continents like Africa, but for the gay community who had, during those 20 years, we had no idea it was going to ever end. And until the drugs became available in 97, 98-ish, we had no idea it was going to end, and we didn't know that anyone was going to survive. To get back to that frame of mind, even separate from the larger political issues, and our synagogue, like many religious communities, became a very important place for people to continue to believe in the possibility of a future, even though there was no expectation that any of us individually would survive.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very profound gift that I think the religious heart and soul have to offer the world. And every Friday night, which is our major service at the synagogue, we would, before the prayer for mourning, mention the names of any members who had died that week, say a brief word about them. But the synagogue maintained a commitment to not turn our Shabbat service into a memorial service. And this is in the middle of the war. Mm-hmm. This is not when deaths were few and far between, but in fact when they were constant, when our social lives were at memorial services or at funerals or in hospital waiting rooms or in emergency rooms. And the synagogue had a commitment then to make sure that we didn't lose touch with joy. Mm-hmm. I find that some of the deepest teaching that we draw from even today. The ability for a religious community to say, as deeply despairing as the circumstances are, God demands of us to sing, to feel joy, to experience love, even in these moments of great chaos and terror. And I think that's a profound gift that religious communities have to offer our world even today.
No question.
I like to say that joy is an act of spiritual resistance.
Yeah.
And not losing access to that is part of what God wants of us in this world. And doing that is an act of spiritual resistance, no matter what the larger political or physical circumstances are.
Yeah. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm speaking with Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum, who heads up the largest LGBTQ synagogue in the world, and Elder Pat Bumgardner, senior pastor of the Metropolitan Community Church in New York City and executive director of the Global Justice Institute. When you each look at the challenges now facing marginalized persons, could you talk about the teachings your particular faith tradition offers for how to deal with setbacks?
I think in different ways, all religious traditions, and I'll speak about mine, that's the one I know, but I think we have to see beyond the immediate and not be lulled into thinking that only what we see is reality. That's the first piece of what my Judaism teaches me. First of all, we've had it bad before. We've had it worse before. And we have to learn that the expectations that life will always be gentle and supportive are simply not an expectation that most Jews have had in most periods of history. And I look to my ancestors to see how they've retained a sense of hope, even in the midst of a complete universe of despair. And I get a great deal of strength from that. Jews, by and large, are not an optimistic people, but we are a hopeful people. Mm-hmm. And now, optimism and hope are very different things. And hope for me as a Jew is very much a religious demand and an actual chiyuv, an obligation. That we are obliged to be hopeful no matter what, that there's a building towards a future, even if our current circumstances are significantly full of despair. And I look back, for instance, to the tales of Moses and the Israelites in the desert leaving slavery, not having a clue of that there was any possibility of liberation ahead, and not knowing whether things in slavery were going to be better than what they were facing. Mm-hmm. And I think our role as leaders, as religious leaders, is to do precisely that, to say to people that you have to believe in and have hope for a future, even if you haven't seen the slideshow or the video or the YouTube that convinces you that it's there. We must find a way to move through the desert, to move through the slaveries of our world, to move toward the promised land, even if no one we know has actually seen it. And that's the power of the story of the Exodus from Egypt, for me, is the belief in one step forward. And Michael Walzer, the great Jewish political philosopher, in his book on Exodus and Revolution, ends the book with saying, ultimately, wherever we live is still some degree of Egypt, of slavery. And the only way to get from this degree of slavery and oppression to a place of liberation is by joining hands and walking through the desert one step at a time.
In the Christian tradition, we don't have the same history that you have that helps people say that what we're seeing right now is not what we may see in the future.
Well, I think, though, in many ways, the Christian tradition builds on the platform that Rabbi Kleinbaum talked about. There is the reality that we follow someone that could probably best be described as a loser and who experienced the ultimate in marginalization execution
right.
for what he believed or how he lived his life.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there is that element in Christianity, and to tie this to our previous discussion, I think we had to dig deep for this in the originating days of my ministry, at least, in New York City. There is that element of what you see is not necessarily all you get.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What you see is not necessarily all that's unfolding there. And I think that Christianity does hold to the promise that life is more than the physical. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that as, oh, you know, you have a crown in heaven. But I say it more as there's a power in us that is indestructible and cannot be diminished by what we go through. And I think my job as a pastor has been to help people connect to that and hold on to that and live from that spot, not live from the spot of my pain or my anger or my suffering, but the spot of my resilience, the spot of the strength I do have, the spot of what my speaking up, what difference that can make for even one person. So I think, you know, our job, both of our jobs, is to kind of, given our traditions, keep hope alive mm-hmm. as best we can.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
interreligious action seems, from looking in, to be so strong in New York City in particular. And it makes me ask, what kind of relationships, partnerships have you all formed that go across denominational lines?
Pat and I are just now in the middle of discussions for World Pride. This coming June is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall events. And we're right now planning a multi-faith, can't really even call it interfaith because we're hoping to be to represent so many different communities,
yeah.
a multi-faith celebration in June of 2019. To mark this 50th anniversary of this moment in history and to do it as religious people, celebrating all of our many different voices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we are planning that. And also I think every year we try to celebrate Martin Luther King's life and legacy together as a way to keep hope, as we said, alive and a way to keep the activist spirit alive.
Mm-hmm.
And a way to not let lessons that those of us who are in our 50s or 60s are more familiar with than those who are in their teens or 20s or 30s.
Are there special challenges to interfaith and multifaith work when you're ministering to LGBTQ people in your own faith community? Or do you only partner with other groups that are equally inclusive?
Well, if we only partnered with equally inclusive groups, we would have no partners,
exactly.
I think. That's the sad reality.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of times you have to look at what's the thing in common we can focus on in this particular instance, and will that give us a basis for having broader discussions?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think the power of coalition work is that coalitions might come together around an issue and not agree on other issues. And I think that's healthy because when you're sitting around the table with people, that's when discussions happen, not when people are screaming at each other. And that's not very much, that's countercultural in these days. So, for instance, I'm happy to work with the Catholic Church on economic justice issues. I wouldn't say I'll never work with a Catholic priest or a church when there are issues on economic justice we might find very serious agreement on, even while I want to keep debating them on a whole range of other issues.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, that has to be, I think as a religious person, I have to stay very open and it's very important to me and to model for our community that we don't only sit down at the table with whom those with whom we agree 100%. And as somebody who came out in the 1970s, had that been my modus operandi, that I would only engage with people, nobody was supporting gay rights in the 1970s.
Right.
In 1973, when CBST was founded, my synagogue, Congregation Beit Simchat Torah, In 1973, there was not a single rabbi in America. There was not a single American Jewish institution, not a single synagogue which supported gay rights. A small group of Jewish people came together, gay people came together in 73 and said, you know, enough with having to choose one or the other. We're going to create our own little community, and all we're going to do is have Friday night services. They couldn't find a synagogue to allow them to do that. They used an Episcopal church because there's not a single Jewish institution in New York City which would welcome them. That was 1973. That's not so long ago. But the only way that kind of change takes place is when we engage with people with whom we disagree. And I know Pat did, spent a lot of time on the road going into synagogues and Jewish community centers and talking to people who would quote the Bible at me when they were completely liberal on every other issue. They would eat pork or lobster or but on homosexuality. Rabbi, but what about Leviticus? And it only because we all of us were in there engaging, respecting them, yelling sometimes, being angry, but staying engaged. Can you possibly, I believe, really change human beings?
Yeah.
And I just want to say, I think it is critical what Rabbi Kleinbaum is talking about under our current administration, yes, that we have civil discourse and that we engage people who are different from us or who are never going to come around to the way we see things in a civilized fashion. Yeah. And that it'd be okay that someone sits across the table from me who's never going to believe that I'm going to heaven and they're going to be really surprised when I'm sitting next to them. But, you know.
Yeah. I'll continue this conversation with the Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner and Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum in just a few minutes on this very special year-end edition of our series, Whosoever You Love. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. I think it's safe to say each of you is a change maker in your own right. And so I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on facilitating change.
I think one of the most important things from my perspective, and I say this because of where my denomination is right now, mm-hmm, and what I'm witnessing in terms of current leadership, I think one of the most important things is to not insist on uniformity, mm-hmm, but to insist on focus, mm-hmm, and to insist on enabling people who have good ideas or something they want to do. Like, my job as a leader is to enable them to carry out that good idea, not necessarily to shape that for them or to limit them in any way, but to let them go as far as they can go. And I think, if I can, like, sort of sing his praises for a moment, I think the beauty of Troy Perry's leadership was, mm-hmm, in the old days, we knelt down before him. He blessed us and sent us on our way.
Yeah.
And we did the best we could do. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't mean to be naive, but I think that's a really critical component, especially in the queer community where, again, perhaps I'm bragging a little bit, but it seems like we have an inordinate amount of talent,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and people who are smart,
creativity,
and gifted and creative. And you don't want to squelch that. You want to enable it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to honor Troy Perry also from my perspective, from the LGBTQ Jewish world. Troy had the genius that in 1972 to turn to the Jews who were in his church in Los Angeles, the MCC, yeah, church in Los Angeles, and a lot of Jews were going there because, as I described, there was nothing in the Jewish community to welcome gay Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point in 1972, he turned to the Jews who were coming to his church and say, leave, go, form your own Jewish thing. You shouldn't be here. This isn't there. Just because there's nothing in the Jewish community for you, go out and create it. Don't wait for somebody else to create it. And those Jews left MCC and created BCC. They created a synagogue with a name that would echo MCC in order to pay homage, really, to Troy. And then they came up with the words to fit the acronym. But they came up with the acronym first. It's called Beit Chaim Chadashim, the House of New Life. Uh-huh. And to this day, it still exists in Los Angeles as a flourishing, thriving center of queer Jewish life. Yeah. And that's another way that Troy actually said, I don't need you here, and you don't need to be here. You need to find your own voice as the LGBTQ Jewish community. Mm-hmm. I want to add to what Pat said. I couldn't agree more. And we're in a place of a lot of purity tests. Yeah. And people have to pass purity tests to be spokespeople, to be participants, to be even walk through the door. And this is so dangerous to what I believe religion has to offer us, which is none of us are pure. We're not pure intellectually. We're not pure spiritually. We're not pure physically. It's a matter of learning to manage and live with and be able to explore the edges. On the Friday after Election Day in 2016, I woke up and I thought to myself, as vulnerable as I feel as a lesbian, as a Jew in this new America that's now been ushered in, how does a Muslim feel? You know, how can I begin to think... We now have a president whose entire candidacy was based on a speech. He opened his candidacy with a speech that was anti-Muslim. That was his, here I am, I'm running for president, and the Muslims are the problem. So I thought to myself, can I begin to imagine what it feels like to be a Muslim in America today? And I just gathered a couple of our clergy. We went to a mosque, the Islamic Center of NYU, for their Juma prayers, which is the major communal prayer for the Muslim community, stood outside with our little signs that said, you know, Jewish New Yorkers support our Muslim neighbors. And you could see as people were walking toward the mosque, they weren't sure if we were there as a anti-Muslim protest group. You could see some fear in their eyes. And actually that experience of feeling, oh my God, somebody's looking at me thinking I'm a source of hate. Just really... How are they functioning in the world today? And as they came up, they saw what our sign said. We had roses to give them. They hugged us. They kissed us. They took selfies with us. They said they're sending a selfie to their mother in Afghanistan or their father in Omaha, or just to show that there are Americans. And all I did is I thought to myself, what would it have been like if non-Jewish Berliners in 1933 had done the same in front of Berlin synagogues? Yeah. And our community has been in front of that mosque every Friday since the inauguration. Mm. Doesn't take a lot. We have 2, 3, sometimes 50. And 6 months after we were there, I said to the imam, Khalid Latif, whom I know you know well, yeah. I said, listen, we don't want to overstay our welcome. Like, is this serving us more than it's serving you? We're ready to stop if you feel like it. He said, no, it's become so important to them, to their community, to walk through this corridor of love in a world which is so full of anti-Muslim hate. Now, this is the LGBT Jewish community of New York standing in front of a Muslim mosque every Friday. He was our gay pride speaker in our synagogue. Wow. And he stood up there and he said, you might think it odd that a straight Muslim leader is at the Jewish gay pride celebration, but I'm here because a lot of people say they're with us, but you actually showed up every week. And we have continued to have this incredible relationship with them. The Saturday that the shooting took place in Pittsburgh, in the synagogue in Pittsburgh, in which 11 Jews were killed while in prayer, the first people I heard from were from Muslims from that mosque. And they said to me, we want to come to services Friday night and stand in front of your synagogue on Friday night with signs that say, Muslim New Yorkers love our Jewish neighbors. So many people from the mosque signed up to stand in front of the synagogue. We had to turn some of them away, and they went to 2 other synagogues. They ended up covering 3 different synagogues because so many of them wanted to be there. So I have to thank Donald Trump for that, for teaching us that deepest of lessons, which is we have to interrupt. We have to smash these narratives of hate that teach us Muslims and Jews should somehow hate each other. Are we going to agree on everything? Probably not. But can we form deep, 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 deep connections? Then we can have discussions and dialogue and debate about things we might have disagreements about? Sure. Absolutely. And that's what we're lacking now. But what I believe that the best of religion can provide.
One of the inspiring leaders I know is my good friend Bishop Gene Robinson, who talks about the essential need to move beyond tolerance and even acceptance of LGBTQ persons to nothing less than celebration.
Totally agree.
Delighting in the rainbow identities of God's people. How can we get more people to see the importance of that? It is our differences that lead us to a better understanding of spirituality, not some enforced conformity.
I think the power of the movement has been people hearing real life human beings talk about what their lives are like. I don't think theory works so well, or it doesn't change many people that I know. What really changes people is human connection. Just like the Jews and Muslims in these two communities are transformed forever because they actually know each other. That's going to change how they see, how they function. And theory only takes you so far. And the key thing, and unfortunately, because of the increasing isolation that social media is creating, the increased focus on purity and spending time only with people with whom we're 100% in agreement all the time, it's a bigger and bigger challenge to spend any time outside of your complete comfort circle. And that's a challenge.
Pat, I want to turn to you because you and I have talked about this. I have particular concern for the cruel attacks on transgender people in the past few years. Would you talk about how you respond to the kind of hate and injustice which comes both at the street level and in lawmaking?
Well, I think there are several different layers of addressing any violence, any kind of violence-related issue. Not to speak for Sharon, but I suspect she and I have always started at the same place by making a conscious effort to reach out and bring in the very people who are being targeted, connect with them on the ground, create safe space for people to express their view and their experience. Things have to go from the ground up. They have to come from people's experience and what their sense of what will make a difference is. So at MCC New York, for example, we have a lot of different, what you might call programming that involves, not only involves trans people, but trans leadership, you know, a community naming who its voices are and who represent them, who can speak for them. So I think that's one place to start. I think another thing to include is, you know, there's more than just Trans Day of Remembrance or that kind of thing, that somehow trans life is part of queer life and part of humanity. So there's no reason, no matter who you are or what the makeup of your congregation, that you shouldn't be talking about the violence that the trans community experiences in America today and continues to experience, or the reality of the trans community when it comes to HIV and AIDS, and making people aware of realities that they might not otherwise be thinking about. And then I think the other thing, as I said, is to look like what you're preaching. I always say the liturgy is the audiovisual aid of the reign of God. So, you know, it shouldn't just be me or my voice. It should look like what I think the reign of God looks like, which is, you know, this wonderfully diverse place, and it should sound like that. And we've had a lot of people in our pulpit that people were a little bit aghast at. That's okay, because they weren't trained in the appropriate theological language or whatever it is, you know, people don't think should be said there or what words aren't appropriate. But again, it's this thing of people being able to tell their stories and people being able to identify with that. And this is really just a footnote here, but I just want to lift up Annie Ruth Powell, from Union Theological Seminary, who died several years ago, straight African-American woman. She used to preach now and then at MCC New York, and she said she would stand up in the pulpit and say in her loudest voice, "Tolerance? I don't want tolerance. That's what I do with bad-tasting medicine."
Yeah. You want to weigh in on that one, too.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's not easy. I mean, that, you know, it's not, it's, these are complicated issues to strengthen and broaden our universes. And there are reasons that are horrifying and some of them very cynical why these last few years have seen this increase in violence. But it's nothing new what the trans community experiences. We had gotten hopeful that there was some political leadership that was moving us in what was going to be a new direction. But the kind of violence that exists is really not new. I think we just had a sense that, wow, maybe we had some leadership. We had an attorney general who was moving some things, and that was very exciting. But I don't think we're in a new place where authoritarian political leaders use vulnerable and marginal people to build up his own support.
Mm-hmm.
And trans folks are an easy target for him. I'm talking about Donald Trump,
of course,
and a very easy target, and to whip up this kind of this hostility towards. And he's using that.
Mm-hmm.
And Jews have been in that situation, and Jews might be in that situation again. He's certainly moving that. So we really know what it means when these kind of authoritarians use vulnerable groups in order to divert people's attentions from what the man is really doing behind the curtain.
Right.
And in this way, it's we've seen this story before.
I'm Welton Gaddy. My guests are Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum and Elder Pat Baumgartner. I want to turn to what's going on with women, because in politics, in business, in organized religion, women are taking the lead in ways that I find profoundly hope-giving. Each of you has decades of experience in leadership and ministry, going back to a time when that was unusual for women. Why is it so important that women are taking leadership now in ways that we've not seen it in the past?
I think it's an interesting question, and I was just reading 80% of the lay leadership of Catholic parishes is female.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the priesthood is declining, mm-hmm. and women cannot be ordained. So in many ways, you could say the hope of the Catholic Church is women and girls.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an interesting thing to look at, like, why is it so important? I mean, there are the obvious answers that we're over 50% of the human race, so it's a good idea to think about us and include us when you're making decisions about how we should live together. I also always feel unequipped to answer that question because in MCC, the leadership is over 50% female, and it's been that way forever. Mostly because of HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of the men I started out with who were my colleagues are dead.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a reality we live with. That's a lost generation of leadership. And so I don't know what would have happened without AIDS, but it kind of forced the issue for us. And so it's a mixed thing for me to think about. I know it's different in more mainline or more straight circles, but for me, it's this mixed. I don't quite know how to sort it out.
I had a friend who said the problem is that as religion is becoming, and it's true, as I understand, in mainline Protestant churches as well, more and more women in leadership, the less and less serious women, less and less seriously, religious leaders are being taken in communities. And like other professions, as they've gotten feminized, they make less money, less prestige, or things like that. So I'm in no position to analyze that, whether that's true or not. But certainly, I think the basic thing is real, that it's a surprise to us only because so few women have been in leadership, with 50 or 51% of the population being female. And we're going, you know, we're celebrating that over 100 people in Congress are going to be women in this new Congress. Yeah. It speaks to the incredible inequities that have existed forever.
Right.
And I think we don't really know what the impact will be, because and we don't really know how long lasting these numbers will be in places like politics. But certainly there have been big changes in religion.
I think the other thing we should add here is that it's really important for us as women who are leaders to not just fit into a structure or a system, or else it won't make any difference.
Right.
We'll just join the old boys club and things will go on as usual.
I'm glad that you said that, because I wrestled with whether or not I wanted to ask you this question or not, because I didn't want to be misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
But I had one of my friends was Will Campbell, and Will used to say that all institutions are evil. I argued with that for a while, and then I gave up and thought it was right. But my point here is that if women move into the same kind of roles that women have been in, we're going to lose what right now we see as great promise. Can that happen? Can women move in and not just think that the real progress is them grabbing what has been the real progressive people in men? What do you think?
I think that you named it. The issue is not power. Your focus cannot be, oh, now I have the power. Mm-hmm. Your focus has to be, I've been called into this. I've been led into this service. I believe in public service, whatever it is. And now how am I going to use this position to bring the kinds of changes that I believe need to happen, so that there's the struggles, I think, for women are to maintain integrity and a sense of purpose, and to keep their focus on that, and to not be enticed or led astray by all the sort of sideline benefits that will come your way. You know, Jesus' thing about you get to be greeted in the marketplaces and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
To not lose focus there.
Right. Yeah. It's an understatement by far to say that 2018 has been painful for many people.
Yeah. We're with you on that one.
Amen. Is that what we're supposed to say?
Right.
I want each of you to talk about where we find ourselves right now, to share your hope for the coming new year, and to preach the message that all Americans need to hear in preparation for 2019. Sharon, why don't you begin?
Thank you. I'd have to repeat some of the things that I've been saying since 2016, which is, first, I think some of us lacked imagination to understand how bad things were in places in this world, and how bad things can really get.
Mm-hmm.
We are part of a global issue right now. This isn't a particularly American issue, although we here in America are experiencing that most notably. I like to say American exceptionalism was 2 weeks before the election, we said it could never happen here. And then 2 weeks after the election, we said it's worse here than anywhere else in the world. And neither of those things, of course, are true. We're part of a global wave of hatred, anti-immigrant, racist, misogynist, corrupt, all those things. You could go to many different countries right now in the world and see patterns that are unique in those parts of the world but share these very, very frightening things. Tim Snyder, professor at Yale European history and a Holocaust scholar, says history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it has a very large echo. Oh. And there are really profound things we have to learn. We've been here before. And I don't say this in an alarmist way, but rather as a historian as well who really loves the study of history. And the place for hope that I come to is deep in my tradition as a religious person, that no matter what, we can't imagine, just as we couldn't imagine to be in this place right now, we can't imagine where we'll be in a year. Lo alecha hamlecha ligmor v'lo ata ben charin lehibatel mimena. From our ethics of our ancestors, it says, it's not your job to complete the task, but that should not free you from the obligation to start. All of us, we can't know what it will be to solve all the problems of the world or even the ones in our city or in our homes or in our communities, but we cannot be full of despair and give up. We must not despair. We must take whatever the small steps are that are within our power. And I believe nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. And I believe that's what God wants of us. And allowing despair to crush us, to push us underneath the blankets into a fetal position, is only giving in to the Satan of the world. And what we have to do is to fight that impulse, to remember that joy is an act of spiritual resistance, to feel love in our lives. We can't do everything, but every one of us can do something.
Mm. Pat?
Well, I don't think I could be more eloquent than that. I think Rabbi Kleinbaum is right. Our job as people of faith is to keep hope alive, simply, and do whatever we can to do that. And I think it's important for us to teach people, at least as Christians, some faiths do have a cyclical view of life, but Christianity is more linear.
Yeah.
You don't have to go back unless you choose to go back. And in fact, you're supposed to be focused on the future and going forward. So I think one of the most important things I can do with my congregation is keep their focus on the future and on what is possible and mm-hmm. what they can do.
Rabbi Sharon Kleinbaum is the longtime leader of Congregation Beit Simchat Torah, where she has served as senior rabbi since 1992. As the world's largest LGBTQ synagogue, CBST affirms and celebrates the lives of its diverse members, provides a moral voice for social justice, and maintains deep relationships with the multi-faith community in New York City and beyond. The Reverend Elder Pat Bumgardner has led the Metropolitan Community Church of New York for decades, serving for much of that time as senior pastor. She is also executive director of the Global Justice Institute, which was born under the auspices of the Universal Fellowship of Metropolitan Community Churches, which continues to be the largest LGBTQ membership organization in the world. Pat, Sharon, I can't thank you enough for talking with us today, taking this time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. I do want to wish you, your families, and your communities of faith a very blessed and happy new year. And I have to say that what you have talked about today is something that is a blessing and a challenge for all of us as we move into that same new year. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us on. I've really enjoyed being with the two of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
This conversation is part of Whosoever You Love, our semi-monthly series affirming the worth and full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion, supported by the Arcus Foundation. dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org. And find all of the conversations in this series, as well as additional resources and information on Whosoever You Love at www.whosoeveryou.love. Now be careful, because this is one of those new web addresses that don't end in .com. It's just the two words, whosoever you, with no space, then a dot, then the word love. Whosoeveryou.love. Of course, you can also find the site from stateofbelief.com. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show, and we wrap up another year. Your generous support of this program helps keep us on the air week after week. We're grateful for that. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Also, tell somebody about us, please. Don't forget, there's still a couple of days left for your tax-deductible donation before the end of the year. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussions you find there. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Happy New Year to you and to yours. Let's resolve to take care of ourselves, to remember what's important in the face of too many things that relentlessly seem urgent, and to stay connected to those who matter to us the most. And be sure to join us next week and next year for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, as always, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.